first thing I'm going to talk about is to talk in brief about legal advocacy, social change, to provide something of an overview. Steve will then talk a little bit about what's happening nationally, and we'll gradually reduce the focus to get to here in Pennsylvania and some hopefully very specific things about what we can do from here. So I'm going to provide an overview about legal advocacy, a little bit about how social change should work, some little bit of history, and then also talk a little bit about some barriers that we have run into in the past, which I think people need to be aware of and know the problems are out there, both on the legal, when you do legal advocacy, as well as other types of advocacy. So, as I say, we're not going to necessarily solve these problems or eliminate these barriers today, but hopefully we will be able to identify some and have people realize that they're out there and take those into account. I think people know, in terms of the history that we're talking about, that legal advocacy has led to a lot of social change, sometimes very significant social change in both the disability and the non-disability area. I think to the population at large, it's the non-disability legal advocacy, social change movements that are probably better known, in the sense you have the civil rights movement on behalf of African Americans, women's movement, and other types of movements like that. Though, while perhaps a little bit later starting, the movement on behalf of people with disabilities is now in pretty much full bloom, and I think is moving forward and will continue to do so. So I just want to talk a little bit about what's happened in the years past in hope of drawing some lessons so then we can move forward. I first just want to briefly define legal advocacy. This is sort of a generic definition, just something to work off of. It's not that that big a deal in terms of the specifics. But we're talking about, obviously, it's advocacy, arguing or otherwise taking action in favor of something, a cause, an idea, a policy, etc. And then either by a lawyer, hence the legal part, but not necessarily by a lawyer, because we want to look at these things broadly and be part of a whole campaign. So while legal assistance might be part of a legal advocacy campaign, it's also can be work in support of a legally based position, working in concert with a lawyer to achieve a result on behalf of an individual or a group. Now, one of the things we want to make clear throughout the day is legal advocacy is not the only type of advocacy. It is the one we're talking about today in its broadest sense in terms of a campaign on behalf of people with disabilities. It may not even be the best or even the preferred course of advocacy, but it is what we're talking about today. And in part, we're doing that, in large part, we're doing that because so much of the rights of people with disabilities have become legally based, whether it's based on the Americans with Disabilities Act or the special education laws. It's maybe true of other groups as well, but it's particularly true that the rights that people with disabilities aspire to, many of which are legally based and have been created in order to achieve the type of social equality that we're going to be talking about. As you'll see throughout the day, however, the way we here are viewing legal advocacy, there are several types, as I mentioned. There's publicity, media activities. There may be direct action type of protests, old-fashioned sit-ins, or some other type form of direct action, lobbying, other types of legislative activity on behalf of a particular cause. All of this can be part of a larger campaign. All of this can be done by different segments of people in support of a larger campaign. What do we mean by social change? Here's one definition. I was doing some research on it in preparation for this and came across a number of different type of definitions, but I thought this one worked particularly well. It's the structural transformation of political, social, and economic systems and institutions to create a more equitable and just society. Proponents of social change target the underlying causes of critical social problems, such as homelessness, discrimination, poverty, and discrimination on the basis of disability. And this is really key. What we're talking about here is trying to get at the larger underlying problems, not as important as they are. If one individual has a particular problem, it may get resolved, it may not get resolved using all different types of advocacy. We're talking about attempting to move the needle, so to speak, toward the larger social change on behalf of people with disabilities, getting at the underlying issues across larger societal types of barriers. And that's what we mean when we talk about social change. While a variety of organizing and advocacy methods are used, social change organizations are characterized by activism, one of the reasons why you're here, cooperation, persistence, and dedication of their members. And an example would be people with disabilities and those working with people with disabilities working collectively to address issues of discrimination, advocates. The house, they're advocating for themselves, getting the assistance that is necessary, such as from lawyers or other types of professionals, challenging entities to ensure equal rights for people with disabilities. So again, it's coming together as a group. It can be many different groups. It's not going to be just one large group of people with disabilities, obviously, as we'll talk about, because there's lots to do and people have different interests. But as we talk about using legal advocacy as a tool for social change, particularly when we ask you later this afternoon to think specifically about the issues you would think are right for such legal advocacy, it's going to be useful to consider some of the characteristics of social change in terms of trying to figure out where do we go from here. So what does social change do, whether it's through legal advocacy or really any other type of advocacy? It builds community-based responses, as I said already, not just solutions affecting a few individuals. That leaves the underlying problems socially intact. We want to try and change the world, to use a very fancy expression, maybe not a fancy expression, but a grandiose dream. We do want to change not just how individuals are treated, but in large measure, how society makes certain decisions, comes to certain assumptions, makes certain types of decisions on not necessarily taking into account the actual needs of people with disabilities. Social change changes attitudes, behaviors, laws, policies to better reflect the values of inclusion, fairness, diversity, opportunity. We want all of those things. Social change assists on accountability and responsiveness among institutions. It could be all sorts of institutions. The government obviously is a big one, corporations, universities, entities whose policies and practices affect people with disabilities. So you have to have accountability and have a way of enforcing and otherwise making sure that people continue down the right path. And social change expands the meaning and practice of democracy by involving those closest to social problems in determining their solutions. So this is a very important one. This is out of this theory or this practice is where you see more and more, it's going on for some time, but continues to grow, self-advocates, people with disabilities themselves taking the lead on how their programs will be structured, how it services, how on the issues that affect their lives. And that's because not so much top-down, real social change doesn't get imposed, but rather it rises up from the people who are most affected directly and spreads in that direction. Here's a quote that I found that I think rang really true to me. On the surface, social change movements appear to be spontaneous bursts of energy, a sweep of people outraged and energized, rising forth to demand some form of change. But in truth, social change movements flow from careful organizing, massive public education, sustained agitation, and at times collaboration across the divides of race, gender, and class. These movements are driven by human energy, intelligence, courage, as well as money. Can't forget that one. So again, as you look at social change, you research it, the examples of successful social change, these are some of the characteristics, and a major one is social change just doesn't happen by chance. It just doesn't, it may appear that it happens by chance, but it just doesn't happen by chance. And a good example of what is described here, I think, is the movement for equal rights for African Americans, particularly beginning in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycott. You know, the popular legend is that Rosa Parks decided one day not to give up her seat to a white person, but the reality is really more complicated than that, and it's really much more interesting if you study it, which I highly recommend, or read about it. Rosa Parks was not just any person. She was an involved member of the NAACP in her community. She had been involved in the civil rights movement already. She had received education and training on nonviolent protest. I mean, this was somebody who knew what she was doing and knew what the consequences would be. So she was involved. Community leaders were waiting for the right opportunity to take a stand on the bus issue in Montgomery, to launch some boycott or other sustained form of protest. There were other opportunities that didn't work out. There were other people on whose behalf they were going to build a boycott around that for one reason or another didn't work out. But again, what you see is careful planning. So while the origins of the Montgomery bus boycott, as well as other forms of social activism, sometimes appear to be a spontaneous burst of energy, as mentioned in the quote. In fact, it came about as a result of a good deal of planning. You take advantage of opportunities that get presented to you, and you see that over and over again in other types of social movements. but it doesn't just rise up one day without doing the necessary groundwork. And then what follows has to be this careful organizing, the massive public education, sustained agitation, the money. All of those things have to follow as a result from what you see in the quote. But what's important, I think, to recognize is it just doesn't sort of happen by itself. We have to make it happen. You have to make it happen. Obviously, we don't have time to explore all the different various social change movements and analyze them in detail, but I do think there are a few general points that can be made that I think are helpful as we think about what we want to accomplish both today and moving forward after today. And that is, you know, there's a tremendous amount to learn from these other social change movements, whether they have to do with gender equality, racial equality, and to a certain extent, what has come before us in the area of disability equality. Okay, so let's talk about just a few of those points. Movements for real social change, they obviously last a very long time. That may be obvious, but that has to be stated. So in addition, while significant progress is made, it's very often difficult to determine when, if ever, lasting social change has been achieved. Sometimes it has to be looked at retrospectively. You don't know it at the time. It's oftentimes very difficult even to find agreement on how one even measures social change. And examples of that would be the very real gains that have occurred on behalf of the civil rights of women, African Americans, and other racial and ethnic minorities. Obviously, you have different signs of real progress. We now have an African American president. In contrast, by many indicators, minorities and women continue to face significant barriers. So it's not as if when one thing happens, that's the end of the discussion. And it's very difficult to measure when full and lasting change has occurred, if it ever occurs. So the suggestion that the social change we're seeking is going to just sort of one day is going to be, okay, we're done now, we can move on to something else. I mean, obviously, that's obviously not the case. It is more of a journey, we're hoping to get to a destination, but it's the journey that matters in the sense that it's slow and steady and it's victory by victory, sometimes defeat, victory. Hopefully, it's, you know, there are two steps forward for every one step back, but there's not sort of an aha type of moment. Another important thing that I think is important for everyone to recognize, if they don't already, of course, is that even though most people remember certain key events associated with social movements, I mentioned the Montgomery bus boycott, there was the March on Washington, there were the Stonewall riots that sparked the movement for gay rights. Real social change requires ongoing efforts by lots of people you've never heard of doing lots of things you've never heard about. So all of us have the ability to be part of that process. This is, you know, is where all of us come in. This is actually very empowering, it seems to me, the idea that we can all be part of this. You know, Barack Obama ran for president and used a lot of the language of how you achieve social change. You would constantly say things like, "You know, be the change you want to be in the world." You know, we're the ones we've been waiting for. I mean, these are the types of that's the kind of language that comes out of social change movements. And it is empowering, and it is something of an antidote to the great leader theory of history, where someone will lead us to an end result. In fact, what we know from looking at past social change movements and what we know from what we've done so far in our own movement, both in Pennsylvania and nationally, is that there have to be ongoing efforts, and there's room for everybody. There's lots of things to be done. And if you read any of the books about the civil rights movement or do other study of any of these types of sustained movements, one of the things that is really striking, or has been striking to me, is the amount of things you learn that you didn't know about, done by people you've never heard of, who do amazing things. And everyone hears about leaders, and leaders are great, obviously, but it's the people who are down in the trenches, and that's basically who we all are. We're the ones who are going to achieve this. Another sort of characteristic or lesson that I think we can learn from where other people have been on this is that in pursuit of an overall goal, there's both room for and indeed the necessity for many different strategies and tactics. And that's one of the reasons why we've gathered here today, to identify those tactics, to try and hone in a little bit on what they are, and then identify specifically how we may move forward from here. There's no one way to pursue the goal, nor is progress always charted in a straight upward line. As I mentioned, sometimes it is two steps forward, one step back. Other times it's one step forward and five steps back. But the reality is, as long as you keep pushing ahead, you can't always measure these things in straight upward lines. And even within one tactic that we're talking about today, which is legal advocacy, there are many different ways to go, many different groups of people, who can be part of the effort. You know, there's obviously, you know, litigation, there's non-litigation, we've mentioned legal advocacy that doesn't involve litigation, rather. We've mentioned direct action, political activity, media action, legislative activity. So all of these various types of activities can take place on behalf of people with disabilities seeking specific outcomes. Some people are most interested in physical access. Some people are most interested in the rights of persons who have mental illness. Some people are most interested in advancing and creating more community services for people who live in large congregate settings. The point is that in pursuit of the overall goal of full equality and inclusion, there's many different ways to go about it and many different ways to measure. And that means everyone can be involved. Now that also, of course, raises the specter of, you know, resource allocations, as well as the ability to be supportive of one another, forming coalitions. Historically, the advocacy on behalf of people with disabilities has been historically separated by disability, in the sense you have, you know, sort of mental health movement, and you have people involved with persons with mental retardation, physical disabilities, and even within that, you have all these different groups. There's certainly nothing wrong with that necessarily, but I think it's fair to raise the question about how effective everyone can be, and can they be more effective with more coalition building, with more working together across some of these lines, and based on that, trying to figure out how we can achieve a legal advocacy campaign or other types of social change working closer together. So you see these principles that I've mentioned and others in play when you look at the history of legal advocacy and people with disabilities to date, which you have. There's a great book to be written, I've been saying for years. My wife's saying you should go read it, but when I say I want to do that, she says, well, you're going to keep your job, right? You're going to keep working. in any event, there's a great book to be written about the history of social change on behalf of people with disabilities in the last 50 years, in the same way there have been really tremendous books written about the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and other movements. I don't think it's been written yet. There are some books that are out there, but there hasn't been sort of an overall comprehensive book. And it would include stories like the of these different constituencies using different tactics. You had the parents of children with disabilities organizing, litigating, using legislative and political action to achieve the right to education beginning in the early to mid-1970s. That was there were both legal advocacy involved, litigation, but there was also, long before there was litigation, there were groups of parents meeting in churches and other neighborhood and homes saying, basically, we got to get our kids into school like every other kid. There's been legal action on behalf of people with intellectual disabilities and mental illness, creating more community-based services. There have been coalitions for legislative success. Obviously, just in the last 20 years, we've had the Fair Housing Act amendments that has brought protections to people with disabilities into housing. The Americans with Disabilities Act, we've had the Americans with Disabilities Amendments Act, which has now just become effective in the last 3 months. These are all different tactics were used, all the things I've mentioned were used to achieve real change, and again, we're not done, obviously. Kids still have problems in schools. There's still a lot of discrimination that goes on, so we have to deal with that. But you see how the different constituencies sought and obtained results using these different tactics. I want to talk a little bit about some of the barriers that exist to using legal advocacy to achieve social change. And my point in doing this is not to depress anyone or not say we can't do it, but I think it's important that people know what's out there. And I'm sure there are others other than the ones that I'm going to be talking about. But I think what's important to know is that people do push back. Not everyone is on our side. Not everyone agrees with all the positions that we as a disability community take. So there are real barriers, and let's talk about some of them so we're aware of them and know how to deal with them as we move forward, or at least be able to recognize them as we move forward. Before I do that, let me say I missed the point. This is important. So ultimately, when we talk about social change, to sum it all up, I'm basically saying we have significant, even if incremental, by incremental I mean small victories, not some overarching, it's over kind of moment, such as increased physical access, communications access, community supports and services. That kind of progress can be attained in support of the overall goal, which is the full equality and inclusion of people with disabilities using legal advocacy and related activities. But it has to be organized, thoughtful, and systemic. And in many respects, this is sort of the key slide, because this is sort of the point of what we're talking about today, and hopefully we'll be talking about moving forward. So what we're trying to accomplish today, all of us, they're advocates here, consumers, self-advocates, family members. We've heard a wide range of people coming at this from different perspectives, thinking about how to accomplish all this, identifying potential issues to address, and then discussing both the legal and the other elements necessary to try and create something of a plan on a few issues moving forward. Okay, now, barriers. There are barriers, as I mentioned. One reason why, you know, certainly we, Disability Rights Network, which tries to use a lot of different tactics, a lot of different avenues on behalf of people with disabilities, but we also have a lot of resources devoted to legal action. But one of the reasons why we do a lot of the other things is because legal action is really a great unknown. As I say here, a few lawsuits are slam dunks and all really are crapshoots. And what I think we've learned over the years is that reliance on litigation alone is a big mistake. There have been issues over the years where we've achieved things, and other lawyers like Steve and others have achieved things through litigation. But I also have had the experience where people have essentially said, well, you're taking care of that because there's a lawsuit, then I can go on and think about other things. And that's one of the sort of mindsets we want to get away from. There's room for everyone, even within the context of something that is the subject of a lawsuit, if it's thought out and carefully planned. So reliance on litigation alone is often a big mistake. And some of the best successes we've had over the years, as we'll talk about a little bit later, have come from this, I don't know what word to use, cross-tactic kind of approach. If you follow any of the legal world these days, you know courts and judges have changed a great deal since legal rights of people with disabilities began to be enforced. We're going back about, roughly speaking, 30 to 40 years. But we know that cases move very slowly. This almost always benefits defendants. There's often opposition to the goals of systemic legal action. People disagree. People push back. People say, you may want that. Even within the disability world, there are different points of view about particular things. There are people who are less supportive of community integration than others. There are people who are less supportive of on the rights of almost any group you can mention in terms of making sure that people live as independently as possible. There are laws that sometimes make it difficult for certain groups. Everything from the reach of, for example, in the context of mental illness, you have how broad should commitment laws be? What about people who want to refuse to take medication, for example? There are all these types of issues where there are large groups of people who may be pushing back against the position that you may be taking. Courts and judges are more conservative. That's both in a political sense, but it's also true just in a legal sense. For example, we're constantly running into judges having nothing to do with their personal politics who have just sort of taken the position that it's not up to courts to sort of tell states and other entities how to run their service system, even if we argue, I think somewhat persuasively, that they're being run in a discriminatory manner. If you go back long enough, even 20, certainly 30 years ago, judges were just much more willing to get involved, and one can debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. The reality is it exists and it happens, and we have to be prepared to deal with the fact that even if courts, I've had judges say to me, well, you might be right, but what am I supposed to do about it? And when you run into, that's the kind of thing that you'll sometimes hear, and that's really potentially a problem. So the whole legal avenue is potentially problematic for that reason. It doesn't mean you can't win, but there are judges who, some do have just ideological opposition to what you're trying to achieve, but even the ones who don't have become more, as I say, conservative, not necessarily in the political sense, but just in the, almost in a social or legal sense, they want to do less. In most situations, legal defendants have become more recalcitrant than they used to be, in the sense that they've learned to push back more, particularly government defendants. They used to be more willing to resolve lawsuits quickly. And that's certainly a change that we've seen over the years, where instead of, it's much harder to sit down and resolve a problem. Instead, that's now the exception rather than the rule, where people can sort of recognize that there's a legitimate claim and the lawsuits gave them an opportunity to improve whatever system is being challenged. Beginning, particularly in the early to mid-1990s, many states, including Pennsylvania, began to vigorously challenge the type of systemic disability cases that had been the hallmark previously of legal advocacy on behalf of people with disabilities. As you may know, people began to challenge whether the Americans with Disabilities Act was even constitutional. They began to challenge whether people with disabilities had the right to go into court to challenge certain laws. You see this over and over again around Medicaid provisions, and since Medicaid pays for such a large amount of disability-related services, this is a huge problem where courts have begun to simply say, well, the law may, you know, read one way, but we don't think an individual person with disability has the right to go in and actually challenge the practice, even though the Medicaid law seems to say that they should be getting a particular type of service. If they're not getting the service, it's become very difficult to go in and challenge that failure. So courts have really been much more negative, and as I say, they're also, it's not just courts, it's also these other oppositional forces, whether it's political advocacy or lobbying. So it's not just a legal phenomenon. You always remember that people aren't going to do something that you want just because either you say or you have, you know, as they say, God on your side or righteousness, because they think they're righteous too, and they think they have God on their side, and it becomes really problematic. A couple other barriers, quickly. Fourth, the law itself has just gotten more negative, as I mentioned, the interpretation of the ADA, medical assistance. Judges have become more conservative, so the rulings have made it more difficult. You know, and I think a really good example of this is the Olmstead decision, which is, if not the most famous, one of the most famous legal decisions on behalf of people with disabilities. This is a decision that the Supreme Court said that being unnecessarily institutionalized is a form of discrimination, and that people have a right to live in community settings if they're able to do so. But then they added subject to a whole bunch of qualifications, and I think one of the reasons why I think Olmstead is a good example of the phenomenon that I'm talking about is that while it was a good decision, there were also lots of things in the Olmstead decision that if you're a state, you're sort of not that unhappy with either, in the sense that there are different types of ways you can push back. So it basically empowered, I think, both sides in the debate. So even what's sometimes viewed as a clear victory on behalf of people with disabilities, and it certainly was an important victory, wasn't a unconditional or absolute victory. And in the 10 years since the Olmstead decision was passed, we've all continued to struggle with making sure that people with disabilities do receive services in integrated settings, getting the supports and services they need so they don't have to be unnecessarily in nursing homes, large state facilities, and large private facilities as well. Okay, and then I guess finally it's important to talk about just practical obstacles. This is where money comes in. I mean, lawsuits cost a lot of money. Legal services cost a lot of money. You have to oftentimes pay expert witnesses. I had the happy occasion just recently to be told by an expert witness he'd be happy to help as long as we paid him $3,500 every day. You have to come up with this money somehow. Sometimes groups can do it. Obviously, you know, through the Disability Rights Network, we get funding to do some of this. But the reality is, it requires, just on a very practical level, and not just cash money, it requires time, it requires effort, it requires resource allocation. And these are not the easiest decisions to make in terms of where you spend some of that money. And that's why you know, you have to make those decisions with media campaigns, lobbying campaigns. All of these types of things are the same. So any effort, the costs have to be considered, you know, carefully before moving forward. And then just one final point before I turn it over to Steve. I think it's important to think about what, if any, impact systemic legal action and other types of advocacy campaigns that we're talking about have on the relationship you have with the defendant on issues that you're not dealing with as the subject of litigation or the legal advocacy campaign. Lots of us, I just can tell from where everyone is from, we certainly do, and lots of other people, just use the example of the Department of Public Welfare here and other state and local government entities. You deal with them on many different issues. It's not just one issue. You deal with them maybe on 10 or 20 or 100 different issues. And so you have to at least think about how legal and other advocacy action on one issue will affect the ability to address other issues. And this is what calls into question, you know, when you live in a world, as we do, of limited resources. They appear to be becoming more limited by the day, unfortunately, but in a world of limited resources, you know, I'll just use one example. A lawsuit that seeks funding for additional services for one group, does that adversely impact another group? The answer might be it might, we don't care. It might be it does, we do care, we have to work it out. There are a lot of different answers, and I'm not suggesting at all that one shouldn't go forward with any type of legal advocacy campaign that they think is important. What I am suggesting is that since not everyone gets everything, and there's a tension that has to be recognized and looked at before necessarily going forward, this has to be part of the discussion that we all have when we decide we're going to work on issue X and the tactics and strategies we're going to have to achieve our goal is going to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have to bring into the discussion, okay, what impact is that going to have, particularly those of us who work at programs or associations, wherever you are, that operate on a cross-disability basis. How do you figure out how to deal with those types of issues? Those are not easy issues to resolve. My point is not necessarily to go ahead, but rather to think about potential problems before they arise and take the necessary action in your planning to avoid them. So those are some of the barriers that I think that people are likely to face. And do people have any questions or comments before we move on? Yes.
Just a comment about the Olmsted decision. When it started, it was implemented, they were supposed to have a 5-year Olmsted plan in Pennsylvania. And some, I think it was Ohio, has that. New Jersey. So other states have an Olmsted plan, but Pennsylvania really don't have that yet.
Is
there any progress for that?
The question is about what Pennsylvania has done in terms of Olmsted plans. As part of the Olmsted decision, there was the court said that a state should have a plan in which they figured out a method by which people would be identified as being initially institutionalized and then moving forward to having them move to community services. Steve can address this a little bit as well because he has a national perspective, but certainly in Pennsylvania, you know, there's been mixed success in the sense that there have been attempts to put together plans. It's certainly not a 5-year plan. If nothing else, we're now coming up on the 10th anniversary of the decision, which I think is next month. So there's clearly not a 5-year plan. There have been different types of plans. There was one put together in the MR system and then sort of abandoned. There have been plans around individual facilities occasionally, but there's not been one overarching plan, that certainly not one that was cross-disability, and even within the different areas of disability, that's not something that the state has done well so far. So, and Steve's going to talk about that as well.
My question is, for disability persons that have schizophrenia, paranoia, bipolar, or genetic disorder, should they have Medicaid, or how do they obtain Medicaid?
The question goes to, I guess, Medicaid eligibility. That's just going to depend. It's not a matter of what diagnosis one has or the disability one has. Medicaid is based on a financial eligibility. And so if one meets the financial eligibility requirements, one is able to obtain medical assistance regardless of, it's not based on a particular type, as I say, of diagnosis or disability. It's based on one's financial capability.